Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember when I said yesterday that deflation is bad? Yeah, well, about that. Stick around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 7th of January, Wednesday today. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The news out of Europe today, our news out of Europe, anyway, not the tragic news out of Paris this morning, comes to us from the official keeper of Eurozone economic statistics, Eurostat, it is properly called, and it picks up on our theme of yesterday, the conundrum of deflation, a consistent and widespread decline in prices over time, as I told you. Prices in the EU did, in fact, fall last month. The way economists like to put it is that inflation is running at -0.2% a year over there. Think about it. It makes sense. But as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, not all deflation is created equal, and we, if we're lucky, might be in for the good kind.
Consumer prices in the Eurozone fell for the first time since the 2009 global financial crisis. But it's not entirely bad news. Prices are falling in large part because oil is so cheap, which acts as a windfall for consumers and a stimulus for Europe's economy. Ken Rogoff is an economist at Harvard.
It is a massive stimulus for Europe, and it also hits the right people. I mean, this is going to everybody. There are lots of knock-on effects with industries.
Since Europe imports most of its energy, cheap oil is all boon and little bust. Rogoff says the problem is the European Central Bank has been trying for years to create a healthy level of inflation.
What makes it a little difficult for them is that they've been struggling to get inflation up to 1% and ideally 2%.
Rogoff says that every country isn't seeing outright deflation. Germany, for instance, is still okay. Still, the central bank will be under immense pressure to take action.
The worry is that you could end up in some countries getting into a deflationary spiral.
Howard Archer is the chief European economist for IHS.
There would be a risk of that happening in Italy, for example, and perhaps in Greece as well.
Archer says the trick now is for the central bank to decide which countries should receive stimulus and how much. In the meantime, as Ken Rogoff says,
the oil price shock itself is just good news. It's just fantastic for Europe.
I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
We have been talking for a good long time in this country, going on 7 years now since Bear Stearns, actually, about whether some of our biggest banks are too big to fail, of course, is the catchphrase. And we've been talking about whether the government ought to force them to be smaller somehow and whether consumers would be better off if they were. The subject came up again this week when an analyst at Goldman Sachs argued that JPMorgan Chase ought to split itself into smaller pieces. Not, you know, because it's necessarily the right thing to do, but because it might be the most profitable thing to do. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that story.
Set too big to fail aside for just a minute. Being big has lots of benefits for banks, more than just ordering printer paper in bulk. Here's Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein on CNBC today.
And so you look at it, what's the value of size and complexity? Well, synergies.
Synergies might mean selling a single client services from a range of different business lines. JPMorgan Chase's synergies could be worth more than $6 billion.
But now there's a cost to size and complexity. Extra capital that you need to have. That capital has a price.
That price comes courtesy of the financial crisis. Regulators now want banks to keep more capital in their coffers. The bigger you are, the more complex your business, the more money you have to keep in reserve. James Barth is a senior finance fellow at the Milken Institute. He says JPMorgan is big.
So by being smaller, breaking JPMorgan up into smaller parts, then it turns out there'd be less of a need to add more capital.
Which the Goldman report argues might be a better deal for JPMorgan's shareholders. But before regulators go patting themselves on the back for finding a way to make the banks shrink themselves, MIT professor Simon Johnson says the Goldman report is missing something.
The big issue, too big to fail, the government backing. That's not being discussed by Goldman Sachs. That is a huge consideration for anybody running a big bank. They do not want to give up that implicit government subsidy.
Knowing the government will have your back if things get bad again, Johnson says that has value. He doesn't think the banks will start carving themselves up anytime soon. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Traders managed to turn things around today. Up arrows on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. According to the most recent Small Business Optimism Index, and yes, there is such a thing, optimism among said small business owners is at its highest level since early 2007. As it happens, we've got a small business owner we talk to from time to time. Olala Njenga runs the Yellowwood Group. That's a strategic marketing firm out of Raleigh, North Carolina. Olala, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me back, Kai. I appreciate it.
First thing I want to do is get a sense of ground truth from you. Last time we spoke, you were in a good mood. You said things were looking up and that you were confident in the American recovery. Are you still there?
I'm still there. Q3 is normally a little crazy for us. Just yeah. That's the nature of our business. But I believe that small business in general, the optimism is really kind of through the roof going into 2015. Hmm. My colleagues are feeling it. My clients are feeling it. So I would say that the notions that I made to you a few months ago are still very much true.
Let me ask then the flip side of that coin, which is what do you think might make, I don't know, near term 2015, say the first two quarters, mm-hmm. not work out so well? I mean, what's the boogeyman under your bed?
Well, just by the nature of what we do, I constantly have to look at things that are impacting the industries mm-hmm. For our clients. And so things like not getting some firm decision from the SEC on crowdfunding, that's something that's definitely kind of keeping me up at night. Tax reform is always going to keep me up because you and I have had more than enough conversations around my feelings about taxes. Yeah. So that kind of keeps me up.
When you go to the monthly meetings of the Small Business Chamber of Commerce in town, mm-hmm. what are your fellow small business people saying? Are they all as optimistic as you are? Because in all honesty, you sound way upbeat. And you and I have had enough conversations over the years for me to be able to remark on this. Because sometimes you're down and sometimes you're up, and you're clearly way up.
I'm clearly way up. And I think I've been very frank with you. You know, when things are good, things are good. Yeah. When they're not good, you know, I think I've been very, very effaced about sharing that with you. There is what I like to call guarded optimism. One of the things that bothers some of my small business colleagues is access to capitalization. I think the shift for them has been they were looking at borrowing money to keep the doors open, just to kind of keep the wolves off the door. Right. And now they're really looking at capitalization toward true growth, expanding capacity, capabilities, expanding their reach and their presence in the marketplace. And that has been a huge shift in the dialogue, not looking to just fund today's fires, but looking for talent that can help them solve tomorrow's challenges, looking for capital that can help them grow to tomorrow. So a lot of that conversation is much more forward focused. Yeah. And that is very exciting to me. So that's what I'm using as the basis for optimism.
Give me your long-term strategic outlook for your slice of the American economy, 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years. You know, I'm hoping to have my slice in Costa Rica. I don't know about any other of the small business owners.
Olala Njenga, she runs the Yellowwood Group out of Raleigh, North Carolina. It's a strategic marketing and consulting firm there. Olala, thanks a bunch. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Kai. Have a great one.
The movie Selma opens in what Hollywood calls wide release this Friday to mostly great acclaim. But the speeches you're going to hear in that film being delivered by David Oyelowo, playing Martin Luther King, will not be exactly historically accurate because the studio didn't buy the rights to use King's actual words. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
There was only one instance in which Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. himself took legal action against someone for infringing on one of his copyrighted speeches. It was when Mr. Maestro Incorporated, a 20th Century Fox record label, put out an unauthorized recording of King's I Have a Dream speech.
So King was protective, but protective within, you know, the appropriate boundaries and rules of that time.
David Garrow is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Bearing the Cross. Garrow paid about $500 to use King's copyrighted material in his book. He made the deal with Dr. King's literary agent, Joan Davies.
It was a very easy process back when she still represented the King estate because, you know, she was actively in favor of, you know, getting Dr. King's words and speeches and sermons out there so that people could read and hear the actual Dr. King.
The King estate is now managed by King's three children. Since they took over their father's intellectual property, it has become more difficult and expensive to use King's words, and they have been criticized for charging high fees. The estate charged over $800,000 for King's words and image to be carved into stone on a Washington, D.C. memorial. And the estate has also licensed King's words for commercials, like this one for the French communications company Alcatel.
Before you can inspire,
behold these truths to be self-evident.
Before you can touch,
that all men are created equal.
You must first connect.
I mean, think of all the revenue that they can generate right from licensing that speech.
Kevin Green is an attorney who specializes in intellectual property law. He says the King estate has been fairly aggressive in its pursuit of those who've used King's intellectual property without permission.
I mean, I understand, particularly in a case like the King estate, why they want to, you know, they're in the business of preserving legacy. But, I think a lot of times that does cross over and really, you know, kind of restricts our public domain in ways that are very negative.
Many of King's speeches have already been licensed to Warner Brothers for a King biopic yet to be produced. For the movie Selma, the director, Ava DuVernay, rewrote King's speeches to avoid infringing on King's copyrights.
We will not wait any longer. Give us the vote.
In the original version of this speech, Dr. King says, give us the ballot. By changing just one word, the movie studio avoided a challenge in court from the King estate. But it is very possible that the studio could have used King's actual words without having to pay to license them.
I think that the producers of Selma may very well have a very good fair use argument for using a lot of the words from Dr. King that they were not able to license.
Jennifer Jenkins is the director of the Center for the Study of Public Domain at Duke. She says that there are no bright lines in copyright law. What one judge may see as an infringement, another might allow under the fair use doctrine. But a legal battle like this would likely cost upwards of $1 million to litigate. And if the filmmakers lost, the King estate could put an injunction on the film.
It would be interesting to know how Dr. King himself would have proceeded if he was administering his copyrights. I think that a very legitimate concern is not wanting inaccurate or misleading or bowdlerized versions of his speeches in circulation.
It's also possible that King copyrighted his speeches to prevent anyone from profiting from them. After all, we know that in 1963 he stopped Mr. Maestro. But any attempt to figure out how Dr. King would handle those copyrights today would be pure speculation. Ultimately, it's up to his children to decide how his words live on. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up,
forcing legitimate businesses to pay their taxes with shopping bags full of $20 bills is insane.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But first, let's do the numbers. Traders are betting on new stimulus over in Europe on account of deflation and all. And Bob's your uncle. We get the happy music. The Dow Industrial is up 212 points today, 1.2%. 17,584 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 57 points, 1.25%, 4,650. The S&P 500 gained 23 points, 1.1%, ended things at 2,025. We've been talking energy all week, right? So let's talk retail for a second. How about that? JCPenney said same-store sales in November and December were up almost 4% from a year earlier. Investors took that as a sign that consumers opened their wallets in the holiday season and snapped up retail all over the place. Penny up 20%, 20%. Walmart up 2 2/3 of 1%. Both Macy's and Target up around 4% apiece. What do Pepsi and Campbell's Soup have in common? Well, they are both said to be on the radar of the Brazilian investment firm 3G Capital Partners. PepsiCo shares buzzed up 2.9%, whilst the Campbell's Soup Company traded up 4.4% today, and you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release its November Consumer Credit Report. In Memphis, birthday celebrations in honor of Elvis take place. The king of rock and roll would have been 80. Oh, and it's National Argyle Day, conveniently taking place in the middle of sweater season. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Among all the hustle and bustle and gadgetry of the Consumer Electronics Show going on in Las Vegas, there was a little high-tech corporate policy made last night. The CEO of Intel, Brian Krzanich, said his company is going to spend $300 million over the next 3 years on diversity, everything from entry-level workers up to the boardroom. Krzanich, who runs a company in an industry that has been criticized severely for its lack of diversity, is under no illusions about this.
This is going to be difficult to achieve.
Marketplace's Noel King reports that may prove to be an understatement.
19-year-old Kaya Thomas sees tech's pipeline problem every day. She's a sophomore at Dartmouth and the only black female out of about 50 computer science majors in her year.
A lot of times when I talk to other African-American women, they often say, wow, like, your computer science is super hard. It's kind of this stereotype that, you know, it's not a thing that black women do. We're not computer scientists. We're not software engineers.
Intel is looking to get more Kaya Thomases into tech careers. At big tech companies, African-Americans typically make up only about 5% of the workforce. Latinos and women are also underrepresented. Rosalind Hudnell, Intel's chief diversity officer, says the $300 million will be used to fund engineering scholarships and expand relationships with historically black colleges.
We have had, for instance, initiatives with minority-serving institutions for a while. We're going to deepen that. We're going to broaden it.
This isn't just about college students. Intel has pledged to increase diversity all the way up the chain to senior leadership. Vivek Wadhwa, a fellow at Stanford Law School, says Intel's promise to hire is the most important thing.
So far, the tech companies have simply been kicking the can down the road by saying it's a pipeline problem. Intel is actually now saying that they will hold themselves accountable to being at least at par with the proportion of women who are graduating from colleges, women and minorities.
How accountable? Intel says it will tie executive compensation to the success of the diversity initiative. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
There's an increasing slice of the American population that consists of working parents who are also working children caring for their parents. Employers, some of them anyway, have tried to help where they could. But now the digital economy has brought some new solutions to help people be where they are needed virtually, if not physically. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Startup man Owen Tripp designed a healthcare app for companies to offer their workers. It links people digitally to top medical specialists for, say, second opinions. Some firms bought it, and some surprised Tripp.
Those employers really wanted to make sure that they could offer it not only for their employees' needs, but for the family around the employee.
Notably, parents. So now a few companies let workers' parents and their in-laws use the app. Why? Tripp says it gives employees peace of mind, so they're more focused at work.
And not fervently Googling around to try to make a doctor's appointment for a relative or figure out what a condition means.
There are other new caregiver apps to count your mom's pills, to observe your dad's doctor visits, or monitor parents who wander. And users increasingly want their bosses to pay for all this, says Donna Wagner, a gerontologist at New Mexico State.
The younger people today are a little more demanding. They're like, well, of course I want this benefit, or of course I deserve this.
Will companies respond in general? Well, those chasing top talent might, since they're in a compensation arms race. But many are still assessing if elder care benefits pay off, says Drew Holzapfel of a corporate group called Respect to Caregivers Time.
There's huge value to having caregivers remain productive. But understanding how a company can invest and reap a return is something that hasn't been done.
Technology, by the way, may not be what employee caregivers need the most. Often, it's time. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Medical marijuana in some form is legal in 23 states of this union and the District of Columbia. In Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and Alaska, you can or will soon be able to buy pot to get high just for fun. Pot is what you might call a business opportunity. Best guesses are that cannabis revenues could top $10 billion in the next couple of years. Of course, there are some downside risks, including, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reminds us, the inconvenient fact, economics-wise, that cannabis is still illegal under federal law.
I start at the biggest convention ever for the fast-growing cannabis industry, the ArcView Investor Conference late last year in Vegas, just right for this crapshoot high-stakes business. The casino valet says he's never parked so many expensive sports cars at a business expo. The music playing on the PA system as these marijuana business promoters take the stage says it all. Money, new investment, high returns. That's what the new potrepreneurs are pitching from the podium.
We are a specialty venture finance fund dedicated to the cannabis industry.
There's ProPot star power.
My name is Ricky Lake, and I've been working on a documentary called Weed the People. So yeah, when I was doing Dancing with the Stars, it was
talk show host Ricky Lake is plugging pot as cancer cure. Businesswoman Jill St. Thomas has a new line of pot beverages.
Coffees, teas, cannabis-infused mocktails.
Grayson Hook wants to open a pot resort.
Five-star restaurant, a spa, conducive to cannabis tourism, and 40-room hotel.
And why not? Revenues in this industry are doubling every few years. Trip Kieber runs Denver-based Dixie Elixirs, one of the biggest cannabis companies, with pot-infused soft drinks, candy, fudge.
I mean, if you look at Colorado alone, this year it's forecasted to exceed $700-plus million. Massive expansion.
What could possibly go wrong? Well, the federal government, for one thing. Specifically, Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act, which puts cannabis in the same class of illegal drugs as heroin. Federal tax and banking rules, meanwhile, make routine business activities, like paying the rent or sending product samples through the mail, a nightmare of financial risk. To see these problems up close, I headed to a spanking new marijuana grow facility. It's in a Denver industrial park.
But let's take a look inside.
Cool. Plant manager Michael Williamson showed me around.
This is our alien rock candy. This strain is actually one of the highest tested THC strains we've ever grown.
Wow, and the smell is powerful.
So what you're looking at right now, vegetative pods that we inject with CO2.
The company, called Kind Love, has invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in state-of-the-art climate control and tons of security. And it's got plenty of customers, but, says co-owner Bruce Granger,
banks are nervous to take our money.
Federal money laundering rules don't allow banks that are FDIC insured to handle proceeds from illegal drug sales.
Think about running a business and not being able to use a bank account. How do you do accounting? Most people don't have a bank statement, so it's all cash.
Brooke Gehring runs a chain of Colorado pot stores with tens of thousands a day in sales. Managers carry that cash around in their cars and briefcases to deliver the payroll.
And they have one of our armed security officers with them to collect and sign off for the payment in cash.
Gehring was a bank compliance officer before getting into legal weed, so she knows how closely scrutinized banks are.
As much as banks love fees, they aren't going to risk their insurance or their reputations to bank this industry that still remains federally illegal.
Add to all this a quirk in the IRS tax code that says businesses selling illegal drugs can't deduct most business expenses from their tax bill. So they're taxed not just on profits, but on all the revenue coming in the door.
So they pay punitively high tax rates.
Oregon Democratic Congressman Earl Blumenauer has introduced legislation to do away with these punishing rules.
If you care about money laundering or tax evasion or just theft, forcing legitimate businesses to pay their taxes with shopping bags full of $20 bills is insane. Let these legitimate businesses have fair taxes and banking services. They'll be better off, but so will society.
Blumenauer predicts his reform bills will get bipartisan support in Congress. And he's not smoking something. True, there are still many in Washington who oppose marijuana. But key conservatives, like Republican Congressman Dana Rohrabacher and anti-tax activist Grover Norquist, are on board with liberals like Blumenauer. They all want to give the emerging cannabis industry room to grow on the right side of the law. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which anybody who's flown commercially in, like, ever probably knows already. American Airlines, that is, airlines in the United States, not the American Airlines, capital A, capital A, are the least punctual airlines in the world. That's a study published by OAG that we saw today on Quartz. 13 of the top 20 airlines are based in Europe, 5 in Asia, just 2 Hawaiian and Alaska Airlines are from the United States. Number one, by the way, on the punctuality hit parade, Air Baltic. Go figure that one out. All right, we are done. Today, the Dow up 212 points, 1.2%. The NASDAQ up 57 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 moved itself 23 points higher. That is 1.1% there. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.